Good.
Okay. All systems are go. At least all the external ones. Well, thank you, everybody, for practicing with causes and conditions as they arise, right? That's what we do. That's what we do. And we do it together, and also each one of you has to kind of gauge what's the way for you to take care of yourself. And please do so without hesitation. I just looked down at my talk, and the title I gave it is Living the Questions, right? So there we are. Koans are not just these, you know, weird, little old-fashioned Zen stories. They are our lives, and we have to live them. You know, we've been practicing with koans for, this is the eighth week now, for those of us who've been through the whole practice period. And it's a little unusual in Soto Zen to do that. And we're not doing it in a conventional way. But I think the more we become acquainted with the koan tradition, the literature, the more we realize how it infuses and informs the Soto Zen of Dogen Zenji. And the more we read Dogen, it's sort of, we see this synergy. We don't know exactly how Dogen asked his students to practice with koans. It's not in the record anywhere. And here we are, these many, you know, hundreds of years later, having to find ways to adapt the practice of koans to the 21st century North America. I hope that a few of the classic koans, at least, and maybe not even from the koans themselves, but from some, might be a phrase from one of the commentaries. But I hope that there have been bits and pieces that have resonated with you and have accompanied you through your sitting, standing, working, walking, and lying down practice. Maybe one of these questions or images or phrases has opened something up a little for you, shifted your perspective. Maybe life has presented you with some koans along the way as well. And I hope that the traditional koans have helped you maybe to hold those life koans in a similar way, open-handedly, with a sense of inquiry, open inquiry, sense of curiosity and patient interest. What is this? Who am I? Who are you facing me? Like Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, and remember what Bodhidharma said? What did Bodhidharma say?
I don't know.
I don't know. Many, though not all, of the classic koans involve a question. And even when they don't ask an explicit question, often there's an implicit question there. So today, what I'd like to talk about is questions, not so much a specific koan, but questions. And I'd like to begin with a poem. If I can do this without three hands, by one of my favorite poets, Jane Hirschfield, who, though she rarely references Zen in her poems, she has for decades shared our practice and our lineage, and it permeates her work, though often not explicitly. This one is called Counting New Year's Morning, What Powers Yet Remain to Me. So it's a good one for us at this time of year, especially if we think of the turning of the year being the solstice rather than the calendar new year. It's coming right up, right? The turning of the year next week or week after. The world asks, as it asks daily, and what can you make? What can you do to change my deep broken, fractured? I count this first day of another year what remains. I have a mountain, a kitchen, two hands, can admire with two eyes the mountain, actual recalcitrant, shuffling its pebbles, sheltering foxes and beetles, can make black-eyed peas and collards, can make from last year's late-ripening persimmons a pudding, can climb a stepladder, change the bulb in a track light. For years, I woke each day first to the mountain, then to the question. The feet of the new sufferings followed the feet of the old, and still they surprised. I brought salt, brought oil to the question, brought sweet tea, brought postcards and stamps. For years, each day, something. Stone did not become apple. War did not become peace. Yet joy still stays joy. Sequins stay sequins. Words still bespangle, bewilder. Today I woke without answer. The day answers, unpockets a thought as though from a friend. Don't despair of this falling world. Not yet. Didn't it give you the asking? I really don't feel like I have to say anything else, but I will. It's my practice. I'm in the seat. That poem resonates strongly for me because Jane Hirschfield and I are close in age, very close in age, and I too daily hear the world asking, what can you contribute to the loving work of what in the Jewish tradition is called tikkun olam, repairing the broken world? Because we live in a world where everything is prone to breakage, as Michael's koan about the rhinoceros fan told us yesterday, we must practice the art and craft of repair whenever possible. The mending of a broken tea bowl with those seams of gold, the stitching together of scraps into a patchwork quilt, the healing of a relationship. Often it's the pain of loss and brokenness that prompts us to ask the questions that lead us to practice. Sometimes before we can even form those questions, sometimes in childhood. But they're there. Sometimes, however, we realize we were asking the wrong question. You may have noticed how often in these old koans, the Zen masters refused to answer the monk's question in the way that perhaps they'd hoped. Old Luzu in Michael's koan from the other day refused to answer at all. He just turned and faced the wall. Sometimes we have to ask the wrong questions to bump up against that refusal. Or sometimes we have to ask the wrong question, sorry. Consider one of the most well-known koans. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Probably just about all of you have heard of that one. Wrong question. Jiaozhou answers, moo. No, no. But don't think he's denying that a dog has Buddha nature. That's the first koan in the Mumonkan, the Gateless Gate collection. And it's also often the first koan the beginning koan in the Rinzai that a student is given in the Rinzai Zen tradition. That's the very mu. And you really give it to mu, right? You immerse yourself, you breathe mu in and out over and over all day long, right? But the Book of Serenity has another version. In this version, a monk asks Jiaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Jiaozhou says, yes. And the monk says, then why is it then in this skin bag? Because the belief, of course, was that you had to be in a human form to achieve enlightenment, you know, so the animal realm would be kind of disqualified. And Jiaozhou answers, because it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. I suspect Jiaozhou is not just talking about dogs. Do you ever know what's best, what's the most wholesome, beneficial thing to do or say, or get, or eat, or drink, and then do the not-so-good thing anyway? I won't ask you to raise your hands. We have endless capacity for delusion. That's why one of our bodhisattva vows is delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And yet, we have Buddha nature, just like that dog. Or as Dogen deliberately words it, we are Buddha nature, not something we can that we have, but what we are. The koan continues. A monk, the Chinese just says, monk says. So we don't know if it's another monk later or at a different time or the same monk. Monk says, does a dog have Buddha nature? Jiaozhou replies, no, mu. Monk asks, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, then why doesn't a dog? Jiaozhou says, because it has karmic consciousness. Blank page. We could say that as a sentient being, the dog or dogs or our consciousness is entangled in the cause and effect of karma. Its consciousness is entangled, as is ours, in the cause and effect of karma. So Jiaozhou is turning the tables on this poor monk or monks, saying, not this, not that. Don't try to pin it down. Don't get stuck in this or that. The introduction to this case goes, a gourd floating on the water, push it down and it turns. Try to pin down a gourd floating down the creek. Or imagine a tennis ball. Yeah. How do you pin that down? Right. A jewel in the sunlight. It has no definite shape. This cannot be attained by mindlessness nor known by mindfulness. Immeasurably great people are turned about in the stream of words. So imagine the stream of words, you know, and we're just a little tennis ball bobbing along. hard to pin things down in the stream of words. Remember that koan Michael brought up, do people these days need enlightenment? And again, it wasn't a yes or no, was it? The answer was, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what do you do about falling into the secondary, which means into the everyday world of duality, right? If you've ever taken a course in basic counseling or communication skills, you will have learned about open-ended questions and closed-ended questions. Questions that open to further inquiry versus questions that shut down the conversation. And yes, no questions are tend to be closed-ended questions. They force the questionee into a binary response. Right? Of course, there are factual questions that require a yes-no answer. Did you take out the garbage this morning? Yes, I did. But when you're really excited about booking that cheap flight to Acapulco, and your partner initially says, yes, let's go, and then they seem to be all confused and ambivalent, if you get frustrated and say, well, do you want to go or not? You probably won't get a very helpful response. But if you ask, what's going on? You seem uncertain now. I want to understand. Then you'll open up the way to learn more and make the best decision. Michael can verify that I do not respond well to yes-no questions. I like to be able to express nuance and complexity when that's what's needed. Those old Zen masters typically didn't respond cooperatively to their students' why questions either. The classic, why did Bodhidharma come from the east, the west, did not yield a narrative explanation. Those old Zen masters did not say, well, you see, Bodhidharma heard along the Silk Road grapevine that all was not well in the great civilization of China. Word was that Buddhism there had become stuffy and academic, so he decided they could benefit from Zazen practice. That's not how they answered. Instead, they responded with seemingly nonsensical answers. The cypress tree in the courtyard. The price of flax in Luling. But what do you see when you really behold a cypress tree? Or one of these ancient red cedars? Or when you watch the price of flax in Luling, or gas or groceries in Vancouver, fluctuate wildly depending on conditions, what do you see? Why questions are not always helpful in everyday life either, because they tend to elicit explanation and justification rather than deeper exploration. When we're asked why questions, we're apt to feel challenged or judged. Why can't you just make up your mind? Right? Ooh. Or why do you always fill in the blank? Why can't you ever fill in the blank? Right? That doesn't, you know, we push back, right? Those kinds of questions evoke defensiveness and distancing. And of course, sometimes it's necessary to ask a why question. Why did that bridge collapse? What do we need to know to prevent some disaster from happening again? But even then, it can all too easily devolve into assigning blame and diverting responsibility, as we see in public life. Blaming can be a way to exercise a feeling of retroactive power over an event that was quite beyond our control. I remember when I used to work as a hospice counselor how often after the death of a loved one, people would grapple with those why questions. Why him? Why her? Why my child? You know? She was a good woman. Why was she taken too young? Why lung cancer? When they never smoked, right? Those why questions can be quite tormenting. Grasping for an explanation is, you know, is a way of feeling more in control. Or someone to blame, or something to blame. The doctor who missed the diagnosis. The person themselves for not getting checked out sooner. Yourself as a parent for not being able to protect your child. Right? But after a while, I would see the focus of the questioning begin to open up. It would start to become, how am I going to go on living? how questions are really powerful. I think the Buddha's fundamental question was, how can we live in a world of so much suffering, of sickness, old age, and death? And I always tend to add, of human cruelty and injustice. You know, how can we live in such a world? How can we be free from suffering? Who, what, when, and where are the questions that you learn to ask in Journalism 101? They can be open-ended in the best way. You're interested, you want to learn more. But asking those informational questions can also be a way of avoiding just listening. It can be a way of filling that space of discomfort with questions. And this is something that we used to remind people of in training hospice volunteers, to be comfortable with the quiet space of listening. Who are you? Who am I? Those are good Zen questions. And that simple question, what is this? What is this? What is this? Is an inexhaustible koan. You may remember the story of Dongshan leaving his teacher to go on pilgrimage, asking for his teaching. And his teacher said, just this is it. The question was implicit in the statement. Right? And these are also questions for our daily life. Who would you like to make healthcare decisions for you if you become unable to make them yourself? What is the most important? What is most important to you in life? When and where do you feel most grounded and connected to the world, to other people? When and where? Where do you feel that in your body, that sense of groundedness and connection? So those W questions can be good ones, too. Dogen's fundamental question was, if we are inherently of Buddha nature, why do we need to practice? And he turned that why question into a how question, to which he answered, to study the way is to study the self. That's how. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. So what was your motivating question that brought you to practice? Has it changed over time? Has it changed from a why question to a how question? What kind of questions do you ask yourself? Are they yes, no questions? Are they why can't you ever? Or do they open to possibility, curiosity, and wonder? The poets of the world have always been well acquainted with asking questions, many unanswerable. The great Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, only months before his death, wrote, or at least it came out, I think he wrote it and it came out, you know, in the last year of his life, composed entirely of questions, called, unsurprisingly, the Book of Questions, El Libro de las Preguntas. The back cover blurb says, these poems are openings rather than closures. And I would agree, even though many of them are yes, no, or why questions. The translator, William O'Daly, suggests how we approach these poems. He says, we participate best in responding to Neruda's questions by running in place. Running in place is in quotes. By running in place with the images rather than by fleeing to the rational mind. And then he credits Roshi Charlotte Joko Beck, American Zen teacher, with that phrase, running in place, as a way to practice with questions. These poems are the lyrical notations of the poet's imagination. They reveal their truths only when we live with them and experience them as they are. When we do this, we reawaken the imagination to the quiet possibilities of wonder and awe. In this state, we ask our own unanswerable questions, and we might come to perceive, reflected within us, the nature of the world beyond mind and sight. I think this guy practices Zen. And has maybe done some koan practice. Maybe with Joko Beck. Then he quotes an earlier poem of Neruda's. The sons of the sons of the sun, what will they make of the world? Will they turn out good or bad? Worth flies or worth wheat? You don't want to answer me, but the questions do not die. So here are some samples from the book. Where did the full moon leave its sack of flour tonight? Why do trees conceal the splendor of their roots? Is there anything in the world sadder than a train standing in the rain? Is it true our desires must be watered with dew? Is peace the peace of the dove? Does the leopard wage war? Yesterday I asked my eyes, when will we see each other again? Ayer, ayer, dije a mis hijos, ojos, cuando volveremos a vernos. I love when there's both languages. In the end, won't death be an endless kitchen? That's for those of you. How long does a rhinoceros last after he's moved to compassion? I want to pause here to share what arose for me in response to Michael's rhinoceros fan koan yesterday. When the monk said the fan is broken, I imagined a fan made of precious rhinoceros horn. Rhinoceros horn is valued for its power to boost male virility. It is one of those products we humans take from the bodies of animals and from the earth, without regard for future generations, our own or those of those beings. When Yangguan said, bring me the rhinoceros, I immediately had this memory of visiting the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto in 2018 and seeing a special exhibit of the work of the photographer Edward Bertinsky, pretty sure he's Canadian, called The Anthropocene Project. Huge wall-sized photographs of open pit mines, tar sands, vast expanses of garbage, bleached out coral reefs. And in the middle of one of the rooms was a holographic 3D image of the last male northern white rhino on Earth, named Sudan. He had died in March that same year at the age of around 45. The end of his line, his lineage broken. He left a daughter and a granddaughter. And they saved his sperm. But so far, there's been no successful way of keeping his line alive. You could walk around. Oh, and he had lived in captivity since the age of 2 when he was captured. You could walk around this image. It was like walking around a massive ghost. Years ago, I had a dream. I was in a cave. It wasn't a deep cave because there was dim light. And I could see the form of an immense animal. This animal had been dead for thousands of years, but somehow was still sentient. And this animal was emanating great sorrow and great benevolence at the same time, as though this animal was forgiving me, a human being, for the greed that had ended its life and its kind. In a way, I feel this dream was expressing a core question for me. How do I or we forgive ourselves and each other for being human beings? Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, wrote in his Letters to a Young Poet, "Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer." So I wonder if sometimes what's called enlightenment comes like that, gradually, without you even noticing it, in the living of it. In the Jukai ceremony, when one formally receives the Bodhisattva precepts, along with a Dharma name, after having hand-sewn a rakusu, which many of you have done, small version of the large okesa. During the ceremony, right after receiving the precepts, there's a line that goes like this, where the teacher says, "To sustain and confirm the practice of these vows, for their reality is in the living of them. I will now give you Buddha's name, lineage, and robe, to clothe you throughout this life and times to come. Let your work be for all beings. This is the way you realize your own Buddha nature." Remember those lines? Preparing for Jukai tends to bring up questions. People ask, how can I make these impossible vows? Won't I inevitably fail to uphold them? And we say, yes. You will. Failure is built in to taking these vows. And that's why every morning we chant all my, all our ancient twisted karma. Right? From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, we now fully avow. And then we reset our compass over and over. So these koans themselves, these precepts themselves are koans. We start out with them and then we cycle back to them over and over again. Even in the traditional koan, Rinzai koan curriculums, the precepts, I believe, come at the end. Here's Jane Hirschfield. Again, just the beginning of a poem called Against Certainty. There is something out in the dark that wants to correct us. Each time I think this, it answers that. Answers hard in the heart grammar's strictness. If I then say that, it too is taken away. One of the best question and answer sequences, I think, in the koan literature is one that just keeps on asking how. And this is case 19 of the Mumon Kan, or Gateless Gate collection. And many of you know this. It's the one that when we have a shuso, or head monk for the practice period, that they recite in the ceremony at the end. It goes, the monk, and this is Jiaozhou. Remember Jiaozhou from Does a Dog Have Buddha Nature? This is Jiaozhou now, a young Jiaozhou, with his teacher. Okay, so Jiaozhou asks Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan replies, everyday mind is the way. So he starts out with a what question. And then he changes it to how. How should I direct myself toward it? And Nanchuan replies, if you direct yourself toward it, you will be going in the wrong direction. Right? Too much striving. So Jiaozhou's not satisfied. I mean, have you ever felt like that? The harder that you strive for enlightenment, the more frustrated you get. So Jiaozhou needs to ask again, but if I don't direct myself toward it, how can I know it? Right? How will I know? And Nanchuan says, the way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Knowing is an exaggeration. Not knowing is stupidity. Don't stick to either one. When you enter the way, you see it as vast and boundless as space. What does this have to do with yes and no thinking? So there we are, right? Again, at the end of that Jane Hirschfield, Jane Hirschfield poem I began with, the world asks as it asks daily, and what can you make? What can you do to change my deep broken, fractured? The day answers, unpockets a thought as though from a friend. Don't despair of this falling world, not yet. Didn't it give you the asking? So thank you everyone for listening. Please be well. Let's chant.